And so now we can proceed with our next appeal. It's Roberto Cavallari versus Aviar Airlines. John Crabtree is here for the appellant, Cavallari, and Jeffrey Marks is here for Aviar. And Mr. Crabtree, you may begin with your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I represent the appellants. There really seem to be three different discrete things going on before the court today, and I want to try to address those. The first is the court raised an issue about whether or not this panel is bound by the prior precedent rule and the Foy decision. And candidly, after looking at the issue pretty closely, we reached the conclusion that the court is not bound, that it may revisit Foy, and that in fact, we believe it should revisit Foy. We do believe the legislative shift to in 1332A undermined the reasoning enough to allow that. And although I can get into it, if you like, I can give you, I won't bury the lead and say, we also believe that the correct outcome is that is the one from Taggart. We believe that as a matter both of text and of the legislative history, that in fact, the better rule for this circuit should be that a legal non-resident is not considered a citizen for diversity purposes.
I think we're, and I appreciate that, and I think that's probably the right reading also, and I'm speaking only for myself. I think we're a little past that where, so now we have your complaint, we have the allegation that's been made, and I know the question for me is the one that's raised in the motion to dismiss is that allegation sufficient? And while you address that question, please address the footnote 24 in the Lowry decision.
I, Your Honor, I apologize, but you're going to have to remind me which one I've read. So which one's 24?
Lowry is the case, and the footnote is the one that indicates that a pleading that a named or unnamed individual in a complaint can be sufficient to allege diversity jurisdiction in a CAFA case.
Right. And Lowry is not the only case saying that. This court has said it more recently as well. In fact, if you do searches for named and unnamed in CAFA, you'll find numerous cases around the country. That seems to be pretty settled law at this point. So we have affirmatively alleged that unnamed class members have at least one and probably many U.S. citizens. We dropped a footnote pointing out the dual citizens count as well, because we could see scenarios where you might have people who had citizenships in both countries.
And because the defendant in this case is a foreign corporation, a foreign citizen, all you need to allege is citizenship of the United States. It doesn't even matter which state that person is a citizen of, right?
That is correct, Your Honor. That's right. And so for that reason, given the allegation we now have, we satisfy the minimal diversity standard of CAFA. We'd also point out, we filed a response to the motion to dismiss. We cited a case called Ehrman. It's a Ninth Circuit case that does a nice job of analyzing what's required in allegations for minimal diversity and the lack of a need for actual evidence. And we also did mathematical calculation showing the statistical improbability or implausibility of the idea that there is not a single U.S. citizen.
In other words, because we're at the motion dismiss stage, an allegation on information and belief is sufficient.
It is, right. Yeah.
But you agree that at some point you're going to have to prove it up. In other words, you'll have to, in discovery, at some point show that at least one class member is a citizen of the United States.
If they dispute that fact, yes, Your Honor, then we would have to do it. We could do it through discovery. There are going to be, we would say, assume tens of thousands of class members. But yes, if they chose to dispute that, then we would. Absolutely. So on the substance, if I may pivot, this case is at one level fairly simple. It's a breach of contract action. We allege that they charged one price, we agreed to one price, and then they charged more. It's kind of like if you come to my house to buy my table and I say it's $100, you give me the $100, you start to walk off and I say, oh, not so fast. I need another 10 before you can leave my house. You can't.
But really it's actually a little different. Let's say you want to buy a car, right? And we enter into a contract. I go to the dealership. I agreed for $20,000. And now the dealer says, no, you can't have the keys unless you give me another five.
That's even better, because the keys would be like the last thing. Yes, Your Honor.
But here you're not suggesting, I think in the Ninth Circuit case, what she wanted was a return of the taxes because she was a citizen of the country. But here what we're dealing with is a situation where you just want the bargain for price that you agreed on for flying.
That's why we're.
You're not alleging that you are trying to change the contract or that, you know, they're trying to charge you baggage fees. Obviously, they're entitled to charge for services for the day of flight, for food, for beverages, for anything like baggage. You're just saying the $775 or whatever it was, that's what I agreed to. That was supposed to include taxes and fees. And now they wanted an extra $80 for me to get on the plane.
It's as simple as that, Your Honor. That's why we're different than Sanchez. In Sanchez, they were pleading a special duty to disclose. We're simply saying we agreed to a price and then you charge us more after we
submit. So let me ask you a question. Here, the court only ruled on preemption. They did not address the 12B6 motion.
That's true.
Let's assume, and I'm speaking for myself only, that we agreed it wasn't preempted. Do we still have to have an analysis on the 12B6?
Well, I think the court obviously has discretion not to do that next analysis, but I do think that in this case, the issues are so entwined, and certainly the defendant's theory of the case is so enmeshed with that, that probably in the interest of judicial efficiency, if nothing else, it would be better for the court to do it all, but the court doesn't need to. The court could simply reverse on the lack of preemption. But
I will say the wrinkle in this case, and I've agreed with a lot of what you said so far, Mr. Crabtree, but the wrinkle to me in this case is this. It's rare that you see in a normal contract case, what you have is a contract, and then there's a dispute as a matter of law on what that contract means. We had one of those just yesterday that you understand. that's the typical case that we've all heard a bunch of times. But this is a little odd at the 12B6 stage to not even agree on what the nature of the contract is. And I guess my question to you, that's my wind up, but my question is this. In a 12B6 case, in a motion to dismiss, what allegations do we take to be true regarding the nature of the contract? Because you tell us in the pleadings, you, your client, said in the pleadings tell us the contract is the carriage agreement and the ticket.
Okay, Your Honor. So.
And then opposing counsel says, no, there's a lot more and we're attaching this a lot more. Because that seems to be really the nub of what's going on here on the non-preemption side of things.
It definitely is the nub, Your Honor. So let me address. Fortunately for us, we have a regulation that goes directly to the issue of contract formation when passengers buy airline tickets.
Well, let me stop you right there for one second. Do we get there at 12B6? In other words, I mean, those seem to be legal issues. And honestly, they seem to be factual issues about the nature of the incorporation and lots of other things that seem to be outside of what an allegation of a contract is. In other words, let's take a different case. And the case is, I have a contract. My contract is, I'll use your car, the Judge Legault's car example. I agree to buy the car for $20,000. End of story. And opposing counsel in the motion to dismiss says, well, wait a minute. He didn't attach the five documents that were signed on the day of the purchase that we signed, and those make up the contract. We wouldn't decide what the contract actually is at the motion to dismiss stage, would we? Wouldn't we
not
just say
in that case, because there's a difference. And the difference, Judge Locke, is that unlike just about anywhere else, we have a very clear scheme for determining what is the contract as a matter of law. So, normally you would think of generic common law concepts of contract formation, right? And you might get into a factual hullabaloo about what is or was not the contract. But in this instance, very unusually, because we now have this express preemption on contract formation that steps in and says, you cannot have anything in the contract if you don't comply with these requisites for incorporation. And so for that reason, this is a little bit different. We actually have regulations that spell it straight out and say, this is what the contract is as a matter of law. So since it's 12B6, legal issues count. No one disputes what the ticket was. No one disputes what the conditions of carriage was. The issue is whether or not these other things also should be deemed part of the contract. And we have,
I don't think there's any factual issues that go into that, even as dictated by the regulations. There's no fact of what was on the website, because a lot of that seems to have applied here. What notices were on the website? In other words, there's a lot of universe of documents that go into what seem to be an intensive determination of whether something was incorporated or not.
Well, Your Honor, actually, there's not much dispute about what's on the website. What is a dispute is about whether something is incorporated or not. And in this instance, and there's no dispute about, again, the ticket or the conditions of carriage. And the conditions of carriage, we agree on what it is, and you read it. And at the end, there are three web pages it refers to, two of which have no faint pertinence at all. The third does have, if it were incorporated, does talk about taxes being beyond this, being an additional thing they can charge. That argument, even if it, first of all, it's not incorporated properly, as we argue, as a matter of law under the regulation. So under, as a matter of law, not incorporated, because the face of the contract does not do it, does not say it is incorporated. But even if it were, that provision would fail as a matter of law for the defendants here for several reasons. One, it's the defendants already, we've alleged that the charge was not actually a tax or payment to a third party, which is all that portion handles. Two, the defendants have already conceded that they kept part of that money. So that kind of kills it as a matter of law. Three, the ticket says all taxes were included. And four, the box where there, if there were to be another charge, it doesn't have the charge inside of it. So for four discrete reasons, that wouldn't be enough. And so let me move on for a second. The defendant, Avior, then moves to other pages on its website that its website hosts and says, well, these other pages should come in. But there's not even a colorable argument for the incorporation of those pages because, as a matter of law, the conditions of carriage do not even refer to
it. If the response, though, is there, these are part of the contract, whether incorporated or not. I mean, you don't have to have something incorporated to be a contract. You can have a separate agreement in addition to the ticket and in addition to the carriage contract. If those other documents might make up a contract, although not alleged in the complaint, it would seem to me that we have a factual dispute about the scope or nature of the overlying contract and not something that we can determine as a matter of law.
There is absolutely nothing in this record to suggest that we entered a discrete contract other than the condition of carriage. It's not alleged. It's not even been argued by the other side. The only argument would be that these are part of the contract. There's no argument for discrete additional arguments in this record, Your Honor. So that's not an issue. And again, as a matter of law, you actually have to have active incorporation in airline transactions. You have a contract, which is the ticket, which has conditions of carriage, and then the conditions of carriage must expressly incorporate and comply with other notice requirements that don't even come close here. So those other documents that are happen to be hosted on the webpage are exactly the kind of thing that this regulation is meant to avoid, so that a reasonable consumer can read their conditions of carriage, look at it, and they don't have to go hunting around. And the reason, that's what this regulatory scheme is for, and it is a very clear regulatory scheme. So for each of those reasons, and I see I'm over, we would argue that the motion dismissed should be denied. On the merits, we should survive 12b-6, and that clearly there's no preemption. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Crabtree. We'll hear from Mr. Marks.
May it please the court, Jeffrey Marks on behalf of the Appley Avior Airlines. I want to start because I need to be candid with the court. What I filed yesterday or the day before, it's all become a blur, was in response to the court's inquiry about the motion to amend. I did not file that necessarily as a motion to dismiss. I think I checked that box on CMECF because that appeared to be the only one that would allow me to link through. So to the extent that the court treats it as a motion to dismiss, that's the court's prerogative, but I just want to be candid with the court, which was it wasn't my intention to have my response to the court's jurisdictional inquiry be treated as a motion to dismiss.
Does that mean you, obviously we have to independently determine it, but does that mean that you agree, Mr. Marks, that now that the complaint has been amended, that there is sufficient allegations?
The answer is yes, partially yes, and partially no. What has happened in my mind is that the court has followed 1653 in the case law, which says that it's permissible for a plaintiff to amend a complaint even on appeal. And the court has given the plaintiff permission to do that. What they've done is now include and change their allegation, which I believe was previously defective on the post-FOIA analysis, the court's original jurisdiction question. Had that not occurred, I think we would be having a much more extensive a discussion on whether or not there's appellate jurisdiction or subject matter jurisdiction at all. With the amendment, the allegation is as a class of at least an unnamed class, at least one unnamed member is a U.S. citizen. In the response, and I put that in quotation marks, to what the court's treating as my motion to dismiss, they cite a Ninth Circuit case which says that information and belief is acceptable for determining allegations of jurisdiction for a citizen. That's on a removal case. And the predicate behind that is because removal is subject to state court pleading, which may not be the same as federal court pleading. We cited in our motion two district court opinions, which obviously are not binding upon the court, but certainly are persuasive in the analysis, which is, and the argument I'm making on jurisdiction is that simply stating that there's at least one is equivalent to information and belief with no factual predicate. There's no fact behind that. Simply saying at least one, well, at least one is not a factual basis. But
the counsel, how do we square that with Lowry and MSP and other cases where we've seemed to suggest that alleging an unnamed class member that is diverse from another is sufficient for at the pleading stage?
That's why I direct you to the Clem case, I think, which we cited, or the Combs case, which we cite, which is a district court analysis on unpublished decision, which says the court was looking at the same sort of allegation, the district court. So it's doing the same sort of analysis that this court's doing on subject matter jurisdiction and the pleadings, and said without factual proof of the unnamed plaintiff. I'm not disagreeing that Lowry's—
That seems anomalous at the pleading stage. There's never going to be factual proof because all that needs to happen is a plausible allegation. And it seems to me that it's plausible that of the 5 years worth of folks who have flown from Miami to Venezuela, that somebody on that plane was a United States citizen. That seems plausible to me, does it not?
I can't disagree that it meets the analysis of plausibility. What I'm saying back to the court is that we cited two district court decisions where the court took that to task and said, you've engaged in jurisdictional discovery, which occurred in this case, and where's your factual supporting allegation? Because as we know, the analysis is Rule 11 requires more than just a hunch or satisfaction by rumor. It requires factual pleading. So to the extent that the court is saying—
It requires a reasonable basis in law or fact, a reasonable inference based on law and fact.
Law or fact, correct. And here there's an absence of factual allegation as to that. I can't get away from the court's statement about named and unnamed. I can't hide from that. Trying to meet it head on. What I'm saying is that several district courts which have addressed that issue have said without the factual specification or proof, okay, then that the jurisdiction allegations are insufficient.
I understand your argument on that, Mr. Marks. I don't want you to take up all your time on the jurisdiction thing. At least from my perspective, I understand what you're saying.
Okay, and that's the point. And I want to make one more point on the jurisdictional allegations, and that is that CAFA, while requiring minimal diversity and seeming to be a slightly lesser pleading obligation, still incorporates requirements or the problems in D4 about the home local controversy and the home state exceptions. So, and I think what the court would say back to me is, well, what you're doing really is teeing up an argument to challenge whether or not a class can be certified.
That's exactly what you're saying.
But I feel compelled to point out that it's our position that the mere allegation of at least one unnamed is factually insufficient. I'm not disagreeing that it's plausible that there could be one, but we do require fact pleading in the sense for jurisdiction. And we did have jurisdictional discovery, and all the plaintiff came up with was two individuals, one who clearly is not a US citizen and one under the jurisdictional analysis is not considered a US citizen. So to the extent that there's still a jurisdictional issue, that's, you know, I would say that, you know, there's still a basis for dismissal. Now, having said that, I want to turn to the merits of the case because the court has
refined its jurisdiction. Mr. Marks, before you turn to the merits of the case, you don't quarrel with the CAFA's $5 million aggregate amount in controversy requirement. Is that right?
That's what the statute says, that the plaintiff class has to have damages of $5 million. I have an analysis that suggests, based upon the jurisdictional discovery, that they may not get there, but that would be something for the district court to address on raising the subject matter jurisdiction at the point in time. If in the event that there's a reversal, there's still got to be a class action hearing. And if the plaintiff doesn't meet the CAFA requirements of jurisdiction, then it's out on other ground, other subject matter jurisdiction grounds, amount in controversy, perhaps home state, and your numbers too.
Your answer though, Judge Wilson, is as a matter of pleading right now, you do not contest that they've sufficiently pled that the damages are over $5 million.
The allegation is there. I mean, they made the allegation and I expect that it's based on a good faith basis. I don't believe, I may be wrong, but I don't believe we actually ever challenged jurisdiction in the district court on that particular part of the pleading. And that's not the one that caused the rub in this court and that allowed us to then have the extensive multiple jurisdictional orders and analysis and filings, more than I've ever seen in a particular case.
Well, I'll just say, you know, I apologize. I'm going to apologize on behalf of our court for that. I don't think our jurisdictional unit was aware of the 2011 amendments, which caused the confusion here. I don't think the parties did anything wrong here. You did exactly what you were supposed to do.
And I appreciate that. And I would say back to you, we're as I don't want to say ignorant, because I don't want to, the negative connotation of it, but we didn't raise it either. And so I think whoever found it was creative. And I applaud them for that. It did raise a very interesting issue. And
I will let that person know that you say that.
and we got through it. Turning now to the merits of the case, as to whether or not there is a sufficient basis on two grounds to uphold the dismissal.
Can I ask you about the preemption? I want to get to the preemption real fast.
Okay.
And to tell you what my problem is. The district court seemed to say that this wasn't preempted because this is price related and Woolens wasn't about price. Woolens had to do with frequent flyer miles. But the Supreme Court in Woolens said specifically, quote, plaintiff's claims relate to rates that the airline in that case is charges in the form of mileage credits for free tickets and upgrades. I mean, the Supreme Court itself said that Woolens was a rate case. It seems to me the district court just got that completely wrong. Am I misreading that?
I don't think so when you read the decisions that follow Woolens. And if you talk about price, that I think of the three factors that can trigger preemption, this is a price case. I don't see how it fits as a services. And
the statute uses the term rates, not price. So right. if this is a rates case, and I agree with you, it has to be a rates case. I think everyone agrees. But the question is, the district court said, well, Woolens wasn't, and so that's why Woolens is different, and that's why it distinguished it. But Woolens, the Supreme Court itself says plaintiff's claims relate to rates. I mean, that's a direct quote from Woolens.
And I would say back to you, and the cases subsequent to it, obviously not binding, but let's take the Sanchez case out of the Ninth Circuit, which Judge Lagoa brought up. In that case, the court did find preemption, and the court did so. But the reason,
as I understand it, was that in Sanchez, and I think Judge Lagoa referred to this, the contract didn't call for return of citizens to get the fee. That was the problem. It wasn't in the contract.
The tax that was paid.
The tax rate. Here, right. As alleged, again, this is just the allegations. The contract says that the price included, the total price included cost and fees. And here, additional fee was added, despite the fact that the base rate included all costs and taxes and fees.
And that's why, despite the arguments of the appellee, that there's not a blending of the contract analysis into the preemption analysis, I would say to you, that's why we're relying upon what we believe to be the full contract, which is referenced on the websites, which the plaintiff has desperately stayed away from.
Well, I don't disagree with you that this has been pled in a creative way, in a good way. And listen, plaintiffs are entitled to plead their complaint. They are the master of their own complaint. I guess my question to you, Mr. Marks, and it's a similar question I asked Mr. Crabtree, is aren't these the scope of the contract? You all have a bitter dispute about what the contract actually is in this case. And you may end up being right, by the way, at the end of the day. But at the pleading stage, isn't plaintiff allowed to plead what the contract is? And aren't we bound by that pleading of the contract? And isn't it then for later for the district court to determine after discovery what the true scope of the contract is?
If there's an issue about I'm going to say no. And here's why I'm going to say no. The plaintiff can plead whatever it wants to believe what the contract is. Okay. And they've stated it in a very, very, very narrow fashion. But the court is within its authority to go beyond the allegations of the complaint when there's a reference in the complaint to the website. And it's our position that you can't limit the contract to just what they say the contract is, because the district court said, no, I'm looking at this and I see the contract as being the additional things that are included on the website, which is why it reached the analysis.
Is that true at the 12B6 stage, though, counsel? When we get past 12B6, what you say sounds exactly right. But at 12B6, is a simple reference in there enough where the explicit pleading is the contract is X and Y and X and Y only, and the terms of that X contract are this, and they violated those terms? I mean, that it really is a simple complaint in that way. I think Judge Lagoa said that with her questions. I think she's exactly right.
And that's why, and that's the core of the argument by the plaintiff in the district court on its multiple attempts to amend, which is we want to say what the contract is. And the district court and the magistrate judge, not once, but twice said back, no, that's not the whole contract. You're not pointing two things. One, Judge Lewis said that the plaintiffs rely on the absence of a disclosure. The reason why they rely on an absence of disclosure is because they didn't want to say what the whole
contract. I think the district court and its adoption of the magistrate just isn't right about that. I mean, to me, I've read the complaint a number of times now, as I know all you have, and it does allege allegations of what the terms of the contract are. Now it may be that you're right at the end of the day that those terms as alleged are incomplete, but again, I go back to my question is, that seems to be a discovery and fact issue and less an issue for us to decide at the 12B6 stage.
Right, because this is that's the issue I'm having, Mr. Marks, as well, which is that we're at the 12B6 stage and not a summary judgment stage.
And my understanding is that the court is permitted to go beyond the pleadings, even in 12B6, if there's reference to or the pleading or the four corners bring up the issue. I'm sorry,
but this is very different than, and I'll give you an example, and I'll go to a third DCA case, okay, where you have a contract and it's a 3-page contract, and the complaint attaches the first page only, okay. And missing from that exhibit is page 2 and 3. And page 2 and 3 are dispositive of a particular issue in front of the court. At that point, obviously, under the law, you can include the rest of the exhibit because it is attached to the complaint, right? But if it's not attached to the complaint, you know, you're out of luck. Then you have to go to judgment on the pleadings or you have to go to summary judgment. But here, there's really a dispute as to what does the contract actually mean. And Mr. Crabtree has pled that the contract stands for X, and you're arguing that the contract is Y. And that's really a factual dispute that I'm not sure is appropriate on a 12B6 stage.
Except to use your analysis, or your analogy, I say not analysis, but analogy, there's case law out there that says, and I'm beyond my time, there's case law out there that says, like in the browser wrap and the shrink wrap cases involving links, typically it comes up in the arbitration clauses where the court says, we don't just look at the single page of the piece of paper that was handed to you, we get to go to the links. And that's part of the agreement. So I would say
I'm very familiar with the Metro PCS case out of the third DCA. The problem there is there's an evidentiary hearing regarding the scope of what it is. That's the difference, is all we have is a complaint, which we were to take as true, versus the arbitration context. I think it's a good analogy that, or a good counter analogy is there you have an evidentiary hearing on those very issues. And I think that's where I think we're at, but maybe not. I know we're way past time, and maybe we should hear from Mr. Crabtree on the issue.
Thank you.
Judge Wilson, is that okay? Or?
Yep, we'll hear from Mr. Crabtree.
Thank you, Your Honors. I just want to make a few quick points. One is that if the court wants to look at this through a purely legal prism at the 12B6 stage, then you have to include what federal law has prescribed on a preemptive level, how contracts are formed in the airline transmission context. So you'd have to look at the regulatory scheme. If the court wishes to send that back to the district court, certainly we would understand. But on a pure 12B6 analysis, we would suggest that substantive formation law from the federal government is controlling in this case. I'd also like to point out, in response to the repeated argument or the renewed argument from opposing counsel on Sanchez, that we believe the data manufacturing case, which we've cited and discussed in our brief, is pretty squarely on point. But with that said, we'd simply ask the court reverse and remand for further proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I thank Judge Wilson. May I thank both Mr. Crabtree and Mr. Marks for great presentations. And at least I speak for myself, but I've missed seeing both of you, and I'm glad to see that you're both well.
Thank you. I concur. Aww.
Thank you. Like very kind.
I feel like I've missed
something. Say that. The feeling is mutual.
I feel like I've missed something by not being on the District Court of Appeals.
Okay. Thank you very much, Honors.
Okay. Thank you.